Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We see the headlines out of Iraq, the battle for Tikrit. ISIS advances, ISIS retreats, we see the dead civilians. But there's a whole other story to be told about the living. Those who hunker down, those who collaborate with whichever army comes to town, and those who pack their bags and flee. Over 2 million Iraqis have left their homes in the last 2 years, and the new offensive against ISIS has brought a new flood. This hour on Point, Iraq's other surge, the flood of refugees. You can join us on air or online. Have you ever wondered what happens to those families who leap into their cars and flee when ISIS arrives or the Iraqi army encircles their towns? Do you have friends or family in Iraq who are now refugees inside of their own country? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first this hour from Beirut, Lebanon, is Matt Bradley. He covers the Middle East for The Wall Street Journal. He was in Baghdad last month witnessing the latest human tide fleeing the fighting east and north of the capital. Matt, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us more about this most recent flood of refugees, specifically from Anbar.
Well, the fighting in Anbar has picked up recently, and you know the Iraqi government has said they're turning their attention from their northern flank, which was the Battle of Tikrit, which lasted about a month, west toward Anbar. Now, the major issue with Anbar is that it's a majority Sunni province. And Islamic State and previous incarnations of Islamic State, like al-Qaeda and other extremist groups, have enjoyed some level of sanctuary in Anbar province. So one of the problems with the refugees who are now coming out of Anbar, and when they're from within their own country, we refer to them technically as internally displaced people. One of the problems with these IDPs is that they're treated with suspicion throughout the rest of the country. They're sort of assumed to be Islamic State, and indeed, there was a rash of car bombings in downtown Baghdad. And while that's not unusual in itself, politicians, mostly Shiite politicians, have blamed some of the recent uptick in car bombings in Baghdad on the influx of internally displaced people from Anbar.
Well, let's talk about that. There has been a surge in bombings in Baghdad in the last week, as you say, and they're thought to be linked in one way or another to these refugees coming to the capital from Anbar province. Here is some video, sound from a video shot on Saturday of a car bombing in one district of Baghdad. It shows people watching the flames from afar. So what is the security situation then there, Matt? Is ISIS actually getting help from the Anbar refugees? Some reports suggest ISIS is actually sneaking into Baghdad alongside these refugees.
Well, you know, it's a little bit of both, and that's the difficulty with hashing out exactly what's going on in Iraq. On some level, yes, of course, Islamic State is getting some support from the residents of Anbar, and this isn't new. Remember that the United States forces fought some very bloody battles in Ramadi, in Garma, in Fallujah, all major cities in Anbar province. Because of the Sunni identity of the place, it allows for extremist Islamist groups who are almost always identify as Sunni Muslims, that it allows them to inculcate themselves very easily in the surrounding population. And so that's why Anbar has always been ground zero for insurgent attacks, whether it be against American occupiers or against the now Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. So one of the problems, if you're a civilian who's trying to flee Anbar, is that you get caught up in this vortex of sectarian hatred that is happening beyond your borders. So when I was in Anbar province about 2 weeks ago, speaking with some of the internally displaced people who were fleeing, many of them were complaining that they were jumping from the pan into the fire. Once they leave Anbar, they're basically no longer at home, and they get this rather vivid glimpse of a divided Iraq the moment they leave their home. And that's what's so difficult, is that these people are treated as, and, you know, as I mentioned, they're actually internally displaced people, but they're treated as refugees. Mm-hmm. Many of them were stopped. They drove out of Anbar and were stopped and made to leave their cars and walk across a bridge across the Euphrates River to get into the Baghdad province, which is the capital. The government wouldn't allow them to drive in because they were afraid that they would be, you know, carrying car bombs into Baghdad. And they were stopped at this bridge, many of them. as they tried to contact guarantors. Now, this is a guarantor system that means basically you can't go from Anbar into Baghdad proper without having someone essentially vouch for you and identify where you're going to be staying, guarantee that you're going to have accommodations, and sort of give the government another point of contact in case you come under suspicion for an attack or for, you know, some sort of agitation against the government in Baghdad.
Right.
So these people were saying, look, we're moving from one part of the country to another. You know, it would be like if you were going from New York City to New Jersey because there was violence in New York City and the government said, hold on, you can't cross the river until you have someone in New Jersey say that they know you. And so that's the kind of suspicion that these people are facing, and it's very problematic for from a security standpoint. As far as the government is Baghdad is concerned, this kind of policy is quite sound. From a personal standpoint, and from the standpoint of national unity, it always is. It's just perpetuating this feeling of division amongst between Sunnis and Shiites.
It's very interesting. Here's some sound. You actually spoke to many of these refugees. It's up on the Wall Street Journal website. Here's one you spoke with. This man says people are leaving because they know that once people start leaving, everyone will follow. People are afraid of military escalations. They are afraid of bombings. And here's another interview you did with a refugee from Anbar fleeing to Baghdad. He describes what was going on around his home as the Islamic State and Iraqi forces fought each other. He says, we were in an area with only blocks separating us from the army. The army was on one side, and on the other side we had ISIS, and we were in the middle. One of the rockets fell 3 meters away from us, but thank God it did not explode. Matt Bradley, the UN Commissioner for Refugees, says the situation in the region has become unsustainable, I think were the specific words. How big is the flow in and out now, would you say? Give us numbers.
Well, now we're talking about, I believe it's a little bit over 100,000. And frankly, I think that some of those people that I was speaking with, and this was about 2 weeks ago, some of those people have returned as the military has been able to make some, to regain some ground that it had lost about 2 weeks ago. And again, this is a situation in flux. There's give and take on the battlefield. So a lot of people who, especially those who were frustrated and felt as though they were unable to leave because of government restrictions, they have just decided to turn back rather than be kept at a refugee camp or an internally displaced people's camp on the border between Anbar province and Baghdad. They decided that they would just rather take their luck back at home. So a lot of those people have returned. But in terms of numbers, and in terms of the perspective of these international aid organizations like UNHCR or UNICEF or some of the others who were really carrying the bulk of the burden in Iraq and elsewhere, this is a crisis without parallel. And part of the problem that we've been hearing from a lot of these aid organizations is that the political circumstances need to change in order for these aid organizations to be expected to pick up all of the burden or so much of the burden of accommodating these refugees and internally displaced people. Now remember that this is not just about Iraq. This is not just about internally displaced people in Iraq. This is about massive influxes of Syrians going into Lebanon, into Turkey, and even into northern Iraq. They're jumping from one war zone into another, going to Jordan, trying to go further afield. And of course, then we've seen this beyond the Middle East. We saw hundreds and or thousands of refugees have been killed trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea under very dangerous circumstances and without much help from maritime authorities in those areas. So this is why international aid organizations on a macro level are saying that they simply cannot take anymore, that politicians need to do their part in coming to stop the need for people to move, to leave their homes, that that's what needs to happen. It can't just be more and more capabilities or more and more resources thrown at international organizations, which, of course, they appreciate that. They need these. They need more resources. They need more financing because they're at their wit's end. But so much of what we've heard from the head of UNHCR and from other groups is that politicians need to become serious about resolving conflicts so that they don't create situations of mass migration that are really stretching international organizations to their limits.
Matt, thank you so much for your reporting on this story. Matt Bradley is a correspondent with The Wall Street Journal's Middle East Bureau. He joined us from Beirut. Matt, thank you again.
Thank you. Take care.
Joining me now from Washington is Daryl Grisgraber, senior advocate for the Middle East at Refugees International. Daryl, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So we just heard Matt Bradley say this is a crisis without parallel. 100,000 people in and out of Anbar these last few days, last couple of weeks. Talk about how the situation is unfolding in your eyes.
Sure. To give some context to what Matt talked about as well, keep in mind that there are almost 3 million internally displaced people in all of Iraq at this point. So from the previous decade, there are about 1 million people left displaced internally, and there have been about 1.7 million more displaced since January of 2014. So all of this is happening within the context of a much bigger picture of displacement. And about half of all these displaced people, a little bit less than half, have gone to the Kurdistan region of Iraq, but the rest of them are very much in the lower parts of Iraq, south and central, and sort of stuck there because the security situation is so bad. And so there are people who are, as Matt explained, waiting, for example, to get into Baghdad, and there are sort of informal settlements set up there where people are trying to get by until they can move. But if people are not allowed to seek safety in areas that are relatively secure, the humanitarian needs will only continue to increase.
And so what do they do in the meantime? How do they survive?
Well, there are a few organizations doing some aid. The Iraqi Red Crescent Society is providing some help, in particular to those in Anbar waiting to get into Baghdad. There are local organizations also that do their best to assist. But unfortunately, what's happening is the huge majority of the aid that's happening for Iraq right now is happening in Kurdistan, in those three provinces in the north, and not nearly as much of it is getting into the rest of the country.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the latest wave of refugees inside Iraq. They've fled the fighting between ISIS and their own government, and they aren't always welcome where they end up. My guest this hour, Daryl Grisgraber, a senior advocate for the Middle East at Refugees International. Daryl, you mentioned access for humanitarian crews being the big concern, the main concern right now. And it's not just ISIS you're negotiating with to get supplies in and aid to these refugees. You have all sorts of local armed militias to deal with, don't you, along the way?
Exactly, yes. There's still plenty of political and sectarian conflict happening across Iraq. And in order for aid organizations to get in and serve people, they generally have to have some sort of authorization or permission from these groups that control various pieces of territory, even sometimes relatively small ones. And because of restrictions on not wanting to give humanitarian aid to the wrong actors, for example, the INGOs and the aid organizations are very cautious about which groups they're willing to negotiate with and even talk to, because they don't want to be tainted by being seen as being connected to the wrong groups. And what this has resulted in outside of the Kurdistan area of the country is a lot of people who simply aren't getting adequate aid.
And so how is the Iraqi government and specifically the new prime minister playing into all of this?
Well, The central government in Baghdad is, in fact, responsible for the IDPs, the internally displaced people.
Right.
And at the moment, they are not providing adequate services to them. So, again, as I mentioned, there are some organizations that are helping out and giving aid, but the government itself is also restricted by some of these security problems that are happening. And so even before this latest wave of displacement, the government in Baghdad was moving very slowly and stepping up to take responsibility for the IDPs, both in Kurdistan and in the rest of Iraq. And what's going on right now has made it that much harder for them to really get in there and say, this is what we're going to do.
Some listener comments from Facebook here. Kurt says, most of the turmoil in the Middle East is the fault of the UK and the US. We can't fix it. We only made it worse. We need to go home, take all our weapons with us, slam on an arms embargo, and let it cool off. Here's Ed, who says, it seems that ISIS is not interested in living together with anyone. They want to establish a caliphate. The Saudi leaders 2 weeks ago said, we don't view our conflict with Iran as one between tribes. We see it as a conflict between good and evil. Here's a caller from Dayton, Ohio on this. Shaka is calling. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. My question is simple. Since Iraq was doing pretty good, I mean, not necessarily that great, but under Saddam, it was stable, and America is the one that broke it. Isn't he who that broke something supposed to fix it? Isn't it a moral responsibility for America to help to fix Iraq, and since they're the one that destroyed it?
Shaka, thank you. Daryl Grisgraber, with the last 10 years as a backdrop and U.S. involvement, what is the U.S. doing now? What should the U.S. be doing right now to help these, what you say, 3 million internally displaced refugees that we often don't hear about?
Yes, just about 3 million. Right now, the U.S. is, in fact, one of the main contributors to humanitarian response in Iraq. Saudi Arabia is the biggest contributor, but the U.S. is right after them. So we are paying attention to what is happening and trying to take care of life-saving assistance to people. But the fact is that humanitarian aid is not ever going to be a substitute for a political solution to the crisis. And that, of course, is up to other parties to make happen.
Let me bring in another voice into this conversation now from Istanbul, Turkey. Maria Fantapier, she's a senior analyst for Iraq at the International Crisis Group. Maria, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
What do you see on the ground and in this conversation about what's happening in Iraq right now, specifically with these refugees?
Well, I mean, it has been mentioned so far. The most important problem is that many of the Sunni populated area within Iraq have been turned into battlefields. The fact that they have been turned into a battlefield, they have pushed out people from these areas, forced people to pack and leave, mm-hmm. and relocate in other areas. Now, the problem is that this issue of the displacement in itself has also a very strong political side, because when you displace in another area, which is in this case or Baghdad, as it has been mentioned, or the south, or most probably the Kurdistan region, then at this moment you will become necessarily dependent on the local political forces which are governing this area in order to get access to aid. So one of the most important issues that there is, like, we are, I think, undergoing into a phase where more and more Sunni displaced people become actually citizens of second class and dependent on other political forces, which are strongest in this moment in the country, precisely the Shia political forces and the Kurdish.
Well, and also ISIS. Is that not right? I mean, we talk about the material issues here. When ISIS came to Iraq, they established a system of salaried employment, much for the youth, marriage rules. I mean, people were able to get apartments. ISIS made significant changes in their lives. So even if you're not ideologically sympathetic to this movement, you get a job, you get an apartment, you learn to cope, you're not on the run, you're not relocating, you're not leaving your family, right?
Precisely. I mean, the issue is that, you know, those one who actually displaced in other areas are, you know, families and people who, you know, let's say families. But the most important problem today is actually the youth, the Sunni youth. So this young, like teenagers or like even like yes. in people who are in their 20s. And for these people, you know, since ISIS came, basically, for many of them, ISIS provided, you know, the material conditions, that better conditions than they before, compared to the situation that they were living before.
Right.
We have to actually keep in mind that, unfortunately, the generation who was born in the 19 and grew up to, after 2003, basically saw no other things than sectarian fights and repression from the central government, and wave of violence in their areas, and is a generation which is very isolated from the rest of Iraq, in the sense that you can find, for example, a young 18 years old boy from Anbar who has never visited Baghdad capital in all his life. So there is these people, basically, they just grew up in this idea that the government and the central government is Shia dominated and is going to repress them.
Right. And so what about that, Daryl, jump in here, the young people who grew up seeing bloody sectarian violence, as Maria describes, who don't see the leadership in Baghdad as representative of them. You said you worry about these Sunnis, these young Sunnis turning to ISIS, dividing more, relocating more, fragmenting more, radicalizing more. Is that right?
Yes, and Maria makes a good point. Youth is such an essential population in any country, and the youth in Iraq in general are particularly disenfranchised. But one of the things that we try to do is provide other opportunities for them. So in particular, jobs, livelihoods are especially important. If people can earn a living and feed their families, they just want to get on with their lives, and they're much less likely to radicalize or do something desperate because they feel like they have no other choices. So this is part of why development is so important within these countries as well, where this is happening. People need to be able to live regular lives at a decent standard in order not to have to make desperate choices.
Let's go to Stephanie in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephanie. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you, Jane. I have a quick question for your panels, and would like to, you know, hear what they think about it.
Yes.
With all the displacements and the wars going on in Iraq, Syria, and the whole region, I would like to, you know, see their thoughts as to whether they think having Saddam Hussein, however repressive he might be, would have been better for all these people or not.
Okay, Stephanie, thank you. Maria Fantapie, what do you think?
Can you repeat the question? Because I could not hear from the line.
Would Saddam Hussein's regime have been better than what we have now, rather than all these displaced people?
Well,
it goes back to an age-old question that we've debated here and other places for many years.
Well, I mean, I think that this question is legitimate, but on the other side, I mean, we have to remind that Saddam Hussein regime was an authoritarian regime who basically kept the country under through violence means and used its own weapons against the civilian population. So I think that the most important, I mean, we don't have to choose between the idea of having back an authoritarian leader or having ISIS or having displaced people. I mean, the choice should be another one, a third one, which is the establishment of a functioning state, Iraqi state, and the functioning institutions that can provide services all over the country without discrimination to all the ethnicities and sects across the country, and can represent them.
Let me get Michael in here from our Facebook page. He says, how can you force a group of people to be peaceful amongst each other when they have no desire for peace? We've tried many things, but ultimately this is a problem that the Middle East needs to solve for itself. Daryl Grisgrabber, speak about the religious minorities, the religious refugees in Iraq right now among this larger group, and their real concern that their communities are simply being wiped out.
Certainly. Last time I was in Iraq was toward the end of last year, and a lot of the IDPs that I met with were primarily Christians and Yazidis, and they had fled from the areas of Baghdad and Mosul when ISIS came into those cities. Most of them felt safe in Kurdistan, but they very much wanted to go back to where they came from. That's home for them, yes, and they are Iraqi citizens. In general, these minority groups tend to feel like they are being targeted to be wiped out. The Yazidis, as many of your listeners probably know, have had a huge problem with ISIS kidnapping women and enslaving them and sex trafficking. Some have escaped, but some, unfortunately, have not survived at all. And this is something that many of the religious and ethnic minorities as well are afraid of. They see that ISIS is there and that when ISIS attacks, there's very little protection for them unless they can provide it for themselves. Now, the Kurds, of course, did help out with that at one point last year, and that is part of why so many Christians and Yazidis made it into Kurdistan in the north. But for people who are left, there's really very little escaping anymore, and this is why they are afraid that their communities are going to be decimated. And it's very difficult for them. They have these ancient historical communities in Iraq that matter very much to them, and that in general, Iraq wants to preserve as well, but it's hard to see how that's going to happen.
Let's get David in Des Moines, Iowa. David, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to kind of piggyback off what you were just commenting on.
Okay.
Because a minute ago you had mentioned how ISIS has stabilized the economy. They've, in some areas, I guess, they've provided jobs for the youth. And Maria, you've kind of mentioned that. But and you don't have to run anymore. You don't have to be transient if, you know, you kind of, I guess in a way, kind of go along with their ideology. But, yeah, what about the Christians and the other religious minorities? I mean, these people are getting their heads cut off. These people are getting slaughtered, and they've lived in that area, some families possibly longer than the Muslims.
David, thank you. Maria Fontapier, what about the religious minorities here?
Well, I mean, I think that even if, as we mentioned, ISIS created some, new favorable environment to some extent for some of the sections of the Sunni population, but ISIS itself is not the answer, neither for the Sunni, neither for any of the religious communities which are present within Iraq. So I think that we should not even consider it as a possible political actor of the future of Iraq. I think that ISIS, it's more of a reaction of what and the effect and the result of years and years of disenfranchisement and frustrations that these portions of population have felt. So I think that here, in order to protect the religious minorities, as it has been mentioned, the only solution is actually, again, to reestablish a central state which is really able to branch out all over the country and to be representative, because without this central state, which does not bear any sectarian signs, which we don't have actually today, even if the prime minister has been changed, I think that there is little hope for any minority and for the Sunni themselves to see their future in Iraq.
Daryl Grisgraber, how many of these refugees are actually fleeing outside Iraq's borders to Jordan, to Turkey? We talk about those who are displaced internally in Iraq, but what about outside its borders?
Yeah, there are not nearly as many as there are numbers of IDPs, but tens of thousands certainly have left since the beginning of January 2014. We've been seeing new flows of Iraqi refugees coming into Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, believe it or not. Iraqis are, in fact, fleeing into Syria because it seems like a better prospect than where they are right now. This is particularly difficult because a lot of Iraqis went to Syria during the Iraq crisis, and when things heated up in Syria, they left and went back to Iraq thinking, well, Iraq doesn't feel safe for me, but it's better than Syria. And now some of those same people are having to go back to Syria yet again. So it's incredibly dynamic where people move and why, but the Iraqis in particular are now on sort of their third cycle in the recent past of being refugees, and they're flowing back out into the neighboring countries just like before.
Daryl, just give us a sense on the ground what this feels like, what this looks like. I mean, we see it from afar, but just give us your sense from a personal perspective.
Yeah, sure. So last time I was there, I met with Iraqi IDPs, as well as
internally displaced people. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes. Internally displaced people, as well as Syrian refugees who had made it into Iraq. And the conditions that many of them are living in are really unthinkable. I met with a family who was living outdoors in an abandoned construction lot. Literally, they had sort of a tarp set up for shelter in the middle of a bunch of chunks of broken concrete. They were practically under an overpass. I mean, during our interview, it was actually hard to hear sometimes because you could hear the traffic rushing by. They had 17 people in their family, and the young man who was the head of the family was probably 35, and he was wounded and couldn't get proper medical care. They weren't able to find jobs, and so that's why they were living in this abandoned lot. After we met with them, luckily they were able to connect to some aid organizations, but for 2 years in Iraq, they had not gotten any assistance.
Hi, this is Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening. Audible.com is our sponsor today. Audible.com carries over 180,000 book titles, plus magazines and newspapers. Many of the books we talk about on the show can be downloaded and listened to whenever, wherever you want. And as an incentive to get you to try the service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint to get started today.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. That is Iraqi cellist and conductor of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra, Karim Wasfi, performing an impromptu show last week at the site of a car bombing in Baghdad's Mansour neighborhood. He wanted to use music to promote the idea of civility in a time of social turbulence. We're talking about what the war in Syria, the advance into Iraq by ISIS, the pushback from the Iraqi army and the Shia militias, what all that has meant for the Iraqis who live there. Where do they go? How do they survive? How can these people be helped? My guest this hour, Maria Fantapier, senior analyst for Iraq at the International Crisis Group, and Daryl Grisgraber, senior advocate for the Middle East at Refugees International. Let's go to Chris in Windham, New Hampshire. Hi, Chris. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I actually had two questions. The first was with regard to these displaced refugees. Are they moving to camps, or are they? What are they doing for housing in the places where they're displaced to? And the second question was: what, if anything, is being done to address the educational needs of the displaced children and teens in these places?
Chris, thank you very much. Daryl Grisgraber.
Yes, thank you for the question. Both very relevant. So the internally displaced people who made it into Kurdistan, for example, were living originally in abandoned buildings, in the abandoned lot I described, in schools that, in fact, were the school year had to be delayed because they were filled with people taking shelter in the buildings. Many people live with host families as well. Smaller numbers of people are renting hotels, for example. What happened was when winter came, a lot of these types of shelter were going to be inadequate, particularly people living outdoors in public parks under tents, that sort of thing. And so the government in the KRG decided to build a lot of camps. And particularly for the winter, in order to get people adequate shelter, they moved quite a lot of people into these camps. So people remain in there, but there are still lots of people living in what we'd call critical shelter situations, which means more informal, probably outdoor shelter. In the rest of Iraq, there are a couple of camps, but where the IDPs move, settlements tend to form sort of spontaneously. And so you'll find people pitching sort of makeshift tents, trying to find host families who will take them in, maybe staying with relatives if they have them. But shelter, in fact, does become one of the most pressing needs in a situation like this. A host community can only absorb and provide for so many people. And this is part of course, why humanitarian aid is so important for host communities as well.
And what about the educational needs of these young people? That was Chris's other question. Chris, thanks for the call.
Yes. So most of the children who are IDPs are not in school for reasons you can imagine, because they're not at home anymore. And a lot of them, it's just not the highest priority for the family to get the kids into school. But as we're seeing in Syria as well, once kids start missing years worth of education, they lose a lot of opportunities and they start to change their mind about what they want to do with their lives. And so it's really important to give these kids options and get them into educational facilities. Now, in Iraq, there has been some welcoming of the displaced children into the national education system, but not enough is being done and there's not enough capacity for all of them. So it's really important to keep supporting the national education system as much as we can as well, so that even the displaced kids can start going to school where they are.
Maria Fantapier, beyond the educational issues, what does it do to communities and the local political balance for residents to flee for a few weeks or a few months or years even? What changes?
As it has been mentioned, the issues that, many of these families are undergoing into the third cycle of displacement. So they're actually...
Third cycle of displacement.
Yeah.
Three times.
In some cases, yes. And actually, when you were discussing, I was just remembering the case of one family I know that displaced from Anbar. And the child, they have four children, and both, the four of them, they are not actually going to school now. They displaced in Turkey. So there is the four of them, they do not have passports, so they cannot even register into the Turkish education system. So, and the one that is 6 years old is actually emotionally shocked and very aggressive. It became very aggressive and defensive, and because he witnessed actually the arrival of ISIS. So I think that what is happening is that even if, you know, the adults are actually very able to displace, pack and leave, I mean, the impact, the psychological impact over the children is incredibly strong. Mm. And this will affect inevitably the future of Iraq. Now, another issue is the fact that precisely looking actually in the post-ISIS phases, I mean, even if ISIS is defeated in many of these areas where it is now established, basically the problem is also that many of the public institutions, for example, the provincial buildings, the schools, the hospital, have actually been destroyed. Mm. So there will be the Iraqi government, they will actually face in the future a big problem of reconstruction of these public facilities. Mm. So the defeat of ISIS is not just the first challenge, but it's also the reconstruction, which is the second challenge.
Maria, thank you. Here's Rafael in Austin, Texas. Hi, Rafael. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My question was, why are we still talking about, you know, a centralized state for Iraq when clearly it hasn't been very viable so far? I believe Joe Biden even mentioned, you know, 6 or 8 years ago about Iraq being three separate states, with Kurdistan, a Shia state, and a Sunni state all split up.
Why not split up Iraq, Maria? Fantapie, thank you, Rafael, for the call. Joe Biden suggested it, apparently. You know, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the idea of this, of establishing a decentralized state has been actually, like, you know, proposed since the very beginning, since the discussion over the constitution had started in 2005, 2004.
Yep.
But the issue is that splitting up Iraq, I mean, you know, it's an idea that by saying it can be easy, but actually in practice it can
harder than it sounds,
because it actually can have the very challenging, consequence of exacerbating the already existing sectarian and ethnic division across the country. Plus, on the top of that, you have the problem that many of the areas between, for example, the Sunni populated areas and the Kurdish populated areas are actually mixed. Baghdad itself, it's a mixed city, and the south, it's Shia dominated, but not necessarily, I mean, even the Shia themselves, not necessarily they are willing actually to go through a process of division of Iraq. So I think, yes, it is harder than it sounds, and I don't see it as a solution for the problems.
Daryl Grisgraber, since ISIS emerged in Syria and then essentially fused with Iraqi Sunni resistance, does the solution lie in Syria at this point, in many realms, refugee situation, political situation, and beyond?
Yeah, well, I think the solution lies in a political resolution to both conflicts, of course. ISIS in Iraq isn't the only problem, of course. There is the government, there are armed militias, there are ethnic and sectarian tensions. So it's not only ISIS that's causing the problems. Certainly resolving things with ISIS would make a big difference. But again, in the end, until the entire conflict is settled and people can have a decent standard of living and support their families, I think that's where it gets tricky, and getting rid of ISIS isn't necessarily going to fix that on its own.
And so, Daryl Grisgraber, how does the Iraqi refugee crisis specifically compare to what's happening in Syria and in Libya?
Well, at the moment, now, when we say refugees, we mean people who have left, yes? So the IDP crisis, the internally displaced people in Iraq, is enormous, of course. We're talking about almost 3 million people, which you could compare to close to 4 million Syrian refugees, so people who've left that country. So it's in that, in terms of scale, it's getting close, but there is this difference between refugees and IDPs and who's responsible for them, and that makes a big difference. Refugees are the responsibility of the country that's hosting them, ideally. Internally displaced people are the responsibility of the government of the country that they are in and of which they are citizens, generally.
Here's Tommy in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Tommy. Glad you called. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I think that the refugee problem is kind of it's a necessary outcome of the wars and the wars of aggression, in particular by the by America and Great Britain and there's some, you know, the Anglo-American complex, and you know it's the when, before, when they were under a secular, you know, one of your guests just said that they needed a government that could extend its power into the throughout the whole country. This is what they had. They had a sovereign nation state, sovereign secular nation state. And we went in there on purpose and broke it up for financial reasons and some political reasons. You know, they were, Saddam was cutting deals with China, was talking about doing things with his currency. And, you know, after the war, of course, our companies make money off of the broken Iraq country. So unless you're talking about U.S. companies losing money, you know, Halliburton, our oil companies, this is the outcome. For them to make money, these countries have to be broken up. And the unfortunate citizens have to die and suffer, and before these wars of conquest that we did against in the Mideast, Iraq had one of the best infrastructures in the world.
Tommy, thank you. Tommy brings up one point. Here's Richard with another in Cleveland, Texas. Richard, welcome to the program.
Yes, I wanted to state that when we went in, when the Bush administration went in. They went in there for a mass weapons of destruction, which they didn't find any, and then they tore up the country. They didn't come in with enough troops to safeguard the people that were scattered after all the bombing, and then the refugees that left from Iraq went going into Syria. It didn't state back then that we cared about them humanitarianly.
Mm-hmm.
Back then.
I see, Richard. Thank you. Do you foresee this, to Richard's point, Daryl Grisgraber, do you see this getting worse, this situation on the ground, as the war between ISIS, the central government continues, all these different militias within Iraq? Do you see this getting worse before it gets better?
Unfortunately, yes. The displacement is continuing every day. And as we saw toward the end of April, just a week ago, I guess, 100,000 people moved from, you know, within Anbar trying to get into Baghdad. That is unfortunately symptomatic of what's probably going to be happening for some time as long as conflict continues. There are ideas that if there is an assault on Mosul this summer, there could be up to another 500,000 people internally displaced. And in the meantime, refugees will continue to actually leave the country as well if they feel like they're not safe.
So, Maria Fontapie, with this battle looming for Mosul, are we going to see this kind of crisis all over again from that area?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that the prospects are not positive for the coming months. The most important problem again is the fact that the most powerful ground forces today is actually groups of Shia militias and not an Iraqi army. I mean, this is another problem that came into the picture since last year, since Mosul actually fell to ISIS. And this Shia militia started to gather under the umbrella of the popular mobilization. Now, the fact that this Shia militia are actually leading the battle against ISIS, in certain cases, as we already saw also in the case of Tikrit, is actually making worse the situation because it's pushing more people, Sunni locals, to actually go out and displace because they do fear that there will be a revenge against them.
It's pushing them out. Yeah,
it's pushing them out.
Let me get Audrey in here from Boston in our last couple of minutes. Audrey, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is, as long as the Sunnis and the Shias are intent on killing one another, basically, what possible peaceful outcome is there? And is there anything at all that the West can do to intervene?
Great way to wrap up here. Audrey, thank you. Daryl Griscraper, what do you say?
I don't know if it's true that the Sunnis and Shiis are intent upon killing each other. They have their reasons that they're fighting, but I don't think historically it's, if you look at history, it's not impossible that they can live together peacefully. So again, whatever's driving that conflict, that's what has to be resolved.
And so from your mind, Daryl Griscraber, the key issues for here as we sort of wrap up this hour, finding a way to get aid to the refugees, for the government in Baghdad to take responsibility for those refugees, and to somehow find some sort of political solution here.
Exactly. In a more practical sense, and maybe on a smaller scale, when people are fleeing conflict, when they are fleeing any sort of human rights violations, they need to be allowed to seek safety. So this is one of the things that's been happening more and more inside Iraq, is when people move, IDPs move, they're not always being allowed into places that they feel would be relatively safe. Matt talked a bit about how people were being asked to have a sponsor, basically, in Baghdad. It's also been the case that not everyone is being allowed into the Kurdistan region of Iraq unless they have connections that they can prove there. But when people are fleeing for their lives, they have to be allowed to seek refuge somewhere, and keeping them out of a particular place for whatever reason, ethnic, sectarian, political, is in fact a violation of their rights. It's one of the most basic human rights we have, is the right to seek safety.
Daryl Griscraber, Senior Advocate for the Middle East at Refugees International. Thank you very much for your time and insights today, Daryl. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Maria Fantapier, Senior Analyst for Iraq at the International Crisis Group. Maria, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, an art show featuring cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, two would-be killers gunned down, free speech, hate speech, where is the line? We'll talk about that tomorrow. For now, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.